I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The next chapter.
We never know that we are in the middle of history when we're sitting here.
What if it was as simple as walking to the past or future?
Who ends up in the middle of the desert and doesn't know who he is or what he is at all?
The next chapter.
On CBC Radio 1
and Sirius XM.
It was last spring when I first noticed Iron Flame by Rebecca Yarros on bestseller lists. And it stayed there for weeks that turned into months and more months. And soon she added another novel, a new title, to the top 10. Rebecca Yarros and a few other authors like her are the leading edge of the romanticy book trend. It's a trend driven by book talk, a hugely powerful force in the book world that can take a word-of-mouth favorite and turn it into a publishing powerhouse. Our columnist and colleague, Bridget Raimundo, you'll find her at Bridge Likes Books on TikTok, opens the program to tell us about the huge explosion in romanticy, books that blend fantasy and romance. She'll also recommend some titles that she's enjoyed. In a half an hour, I'll talk with philosopher slash novelist Scott Alexander Howard about how his fascination with the passage of time turned into his thoughtful time travel novel, The Other Valley. And to close the program, fiction writer and history lover Christine Estima will bring us three of her favorite novels that immerse readers in the stresses and storms of the early 20th century. I'm Ali Hassan. Welcome to the next chapter. The biggest trend in the book world these days is the emergence slash domination of romanticy. And as you can tell from the name, it is a mashup of fantasy and romance, and it is turbocharged the publishing world. Millions of copies of the top sellers in the genre are sold in a matter of weeks, and much of the success of the genre has been powered by book talk. It's a phenomenon for sure, and we have brought in our own in-house book talk star, Bridge Likes Books, a.k.a. Bridget Raimundo, to tell us all about it. She's an associate producer at CBC Books, and she joins me now to talk romanticy and also to suggest some titles. Hi, Bridget. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I've waited patiently for a genre called historical fumer to emerge, which is my favorite, historical fiction and humor, or historical fomity. It's not catching.
It's not taking off.
No, it's not taking off. But this thing, I don't even, can we call this a trend anymore, romanticy, or is it an established genre?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note that romance in fantasy books has always existed.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually probably harder to try and find a fantasy that doesn't have any romance in it, but this has kind of come about as a term that rolls off the tongue a little bit easier, romanticy. And it's now become a popular genre on book talk. I mean, it's always been, but the term kind of as a publishing term, as a marketing term, has kind of emerged over the past year is where I've seen it come up. And yeah, it's a fun way to identify that subgenre. Yeah.
Okay. So tell me, what are the hallmarks of romanticy novels? Can you explain how these two blend into being a genre?
Yeah. I feel like oftentimes it is actually misrepresented. I think you can define it in a multitude of ways, like Game of Thrones could arguably be a romanticy. But I think I see people get it wrong when they define it as half fantasy, half romance. For me, where romanticy gets it right is where the world building, the romance, and the quest of the main character, or the goal of the main character, are all given equal footing. And they're all integral to the plot. So that's the kind of hallmarks that I see in that. The other thing that I would discern is that it's still a fantasy at the end of the day. It would still be shelved in the fantasy section as opposed to the romance section where you're guaranteed a happy ending. There doesn't have to be a happy ending in these stories, and there often isn't, which I think is part of the appeal because in a way it's more real sometimes.
There's a couple of other interesting things about this. I'm looking at the books that you have with you in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
They are absolute, like, works of art very, very vivid and beautiful covers. When you open them up, the art continues into the book. That's interesting and a little bit different. And also from what I've read is that, you know, fans dress up for book launch parties and you know, there's this whole vibe around them. And then the sales of these books are in the hundreds of thousands of copies in a day. So I'm thinking Harry Potter and Hunger Games type of popularity. So how does Romantasy compare to those powerhouse books that went on to become global phenomenon?
Well, I think fandom has changed around it. The way that people engage with these books, for example, you know, you have these beautiful tomes with, you know, these drawn out maps and fan art all over. But you see most of that online as opposed to when I was growing up, I went to those like launch parties at night. And so I think that's the different approach to it. In a way, it's really cool because it can reach a lot more people. And you see these books pop up on BookTok that get a lot of attention, but then it can also quickly fizzle out. So it's so saturated with different titles and people are coming up with so many great things, but there's a lot more to read. So it can kind of be overwhelming for a reader sometimes. But yeah, definitely fandom in small doses these days.
I want to ask you also about the reaction of the general reading public. Has there been some kind of, you know, a kind of snobbery factor about the romance element of these books compared to what the Harry Potters or the Game of Thrones might have gotten? Not as much judgment?
Yeah. I mean, I think whenever you attach the romance label to anything, there's going to be a certain level of snobbery or judgment, even though it is the highest grossing genre that we have today. Just because, there's an idea that you can't have fully fledged stories if we're focusing on the romance. But like I said, Romantasy is fun because you get to focus on all of these things. You're almost writing two books in one, which I would argue is a lot more complicated. Sure. So, yeah, I think that's definitely there. But for me, it's an access point, romance, having them in fantasy. I take a long time to read fantasy books, especially when the world building is so dense. And if I have something to root for, it's a lot easier for me to get through a tome of a book if I'm rooting for the couple. And then by osmosis, I kind of figure out the political intrigue and everything else that's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, I absolutely know what you mean. All right, I'm sold on something that millions of people are already sold on, but you got me. Million and one. Let's go to the first book on the list.
Yeah, so the first book I have is called Goddess Crown by Shade Lapit. And this is a YA novel that feels almost like Rapunzel, like a Rapunzel-esque fairy tale with Nigerian culture and influence mixed into it. So it starts off, we have this girl named Calathea who has been ousted and hiding in the forest of the kingdom of Gala for the past 16 years because her family were noblemen. They were ousted by the king, and so she's had to live in hiding all this time. She gets ambushed on her 16th birthday and has to run away and find this kingdom that she's been living outside of for her whole life. So it's really a story of adventure. It's really a story of finding a sense of community. She's accompanied by her childhood best friend, Nahir, who happens to be her security personnel. So it's kind of that story, or that's the dynamic in the relationship there, which is really sweet to see as well. She also has a companion monkey called Yi. So it's very like Disney princess in that respect.
Strong female lead who comes into her power over the course of the novel. Would you describe that? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but it's definitely an evolution of a young person finding themselves and finding their culture and finding their family as well. So, yeah, I like that as well. She's guided by everyone in this world is guided by the goddess precepts. And some of them, I would argue, are a little bit sexist, saying that, like, men should lead. So it's a bit of a patriarchal society that she's walking into with this immense amount of power. And having been someone who's not really interacted with anyone outside of her immediate close circle for her whole life, it's interesting to see her navigate that in this fantasy world as well.
And it's meant as a YA book. Is that right? You said
that? Yeah, absolutely. So she's 16 when the book starts out. And that's what I like about Romantasy, too, is it can dip into the young adult space. It doesn't have to be these intense romances as well. It can be for young people. And that's where I started with the genre, too.
Okay. What's the second book on the list?
Yeah, so the second book is called The Sanctuary of the Shadow by Aurora Asher. This is a Canadian debut novel, and it's really fun. It's essentially this world where we have four elemental creatures, kind of like Avatar, The Last Airbender. And we follow two characters, so the two characters in this love spar. A hero who has been with a traveling circus for her entire life with these magical elementals, and she is secretly a water elemental, which is rare. And she can kind of prophesize and see in the future, so she's a little bit wary of a looming darkness. And then at the same time, we follow this character named Wraith, who is a man, with wings, who ends up in the middle of the desert and doesn't know who he is or what he is at all. And he just kind of gets the short end of the stick and gets abducted immediately and taken into the circus. And they have to navigate and find their ways around each other when they're actually on polar opposites of this magical power in this kingdom.
So you mentioned Canadian author, debut novel. Mm-hmm. Or debut book.
Yeah.
But also I've seen this on bestseller lists.
Yes. Yeah. It kind of just took off immediately.
What made it so popular?
I think it's kind of that quintessential romanticy that people long for. It has a lot of adult content in it. It's very spicy. But it is the Canadian version of that, which we've been kind of missing in the market. We haven't had a Canadian really spicy romanticy.
Tell me about the spice.
Yeah.
Without giving anything away or saying anything non-CBC-ish, how does the romance unfold in Sanctuary of Shadow?
Yeah, it's an instant love in this one. So it makes sense later on why they feel so drawn to one another, but they do immediately. And so it's definitely on the adult spectrum of the romanticy genre. It gets a little spicy, but that's what I like about the genre as well, is that it really centers a female gaze or a female perspective when it comes to desire and things like that, as opposed to what we're traditionally have seen in like Game of Thrones or things like that.
You're mentioning Game of Thrones. You know, when I think of hugely popular fantasy novels from the past, that's what comes to mind. Mm-hmm. But then that series and the TV show that followed were very dark and violent. Does romanticism get into that territory as well?
Yeah, I think, again, a lot of the ones that have been popularized are by female writers, so it's a different take on the dark and haunting side of fantasy. There's the same amount of world and intrigue and battles going on and dragons and all those things. Mm-hmm. But there is a different approach there as well. I think if you have a romance in a contemporary setting, it's a little weird that, like, you have an enemy or something in your workplace or something. And so it adds tension in this world when you have all of these other things going on. And that just builds onto a romance because there's just so much angst there to unpack.
All right. What's the last book that you wanted to talk about today?
Yeah. So the last book is The Hurricane Wars by Tea Guanzon, who is a Filipino author. And this is the first book in a political fantasy trilogy. And it's heavily inspired by Southeast Asia, particularly the Philippines. And it's a dragon book. I had to bring a dragon book because it's the year of the dragon. So it follows the aftermath of a 20-year war on this continent between the Lightweavers and the Shadow Forges, which we don't need to unpack right now. Just know that they're very magical and very mysterious. And so we follow a warrior named Talasan who ends up in this mysterious dominion, which is basically the Philippines, or I interpreted it as the Philippines, mm-hmm. and it's described as a matriarchy with dragons and streets paved with gold. So I was on board from the first page.
Tell me about the romantic leads in this book.
Yeah. So this is a quintessential enemies to lovers. You have Talasan, who is the warrior, who's kind of been orphaned on the mainland for many years and is searching for that identity and place of belonging. And then we have Alaric, who is the knight emperor and has this really tyrannical father, is just doing his bidding, and he's the Shadow Forge. So we've got a light and dark true enemies happening there, and they have to end up working together in different capacities. And it's a lot of good tension. It's a really fun couple.
Right. So not exactly a meet cute.
No.
But it sounds like it follows these enemies who turn into an arc.
There's an arc.
Yeah.
There's a continuation of what I like about this is that they kind of remain enemies and lovers throughout the entire thing, because this is the first book in a series. They are so stubborn. They're probably the most stubborn characters I've ever read. But I really like to read that because it makes for good relationship dynamics. And so they're at each other's throats the entire time, which is really fun because I really like reading all those like intricate fight scenes, and you've got a lot of like traditional Filipino weaponry that's used and implemented in a lot. And so that's cool to see.
Hopefully at the end they say Mahal Kita, and
exactly.
Which means I love you in Tagalog for people who may not know. One theory I read somewhere is that romanticism is popular now because the world is actually quite dark and people are searching for an escape from that. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to disregard the value of reading something for escapism. There's definitely an element of that in here. But for me, I've been gravitating towards these stories recently in particular because the fantasy grounds me in a sense of reality. I don't think you can disconnect the two in any way. For example, like The Hurricane Wars, the author of that, she studied international politics and peace studies. And you can see that directly in the politics of this world that she's created. And also, as like a Filipino, resisting imperialism and like colonialism is in the DNA of our stories and the way that we tell those stories. So for me, it helps me gain perspective in a way that's outside of the reality. That's what I like about merging that kind of accessibility of having a romance to root for and having these fantasy worlds, because you're building based on your own experiences at the end of the day.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in and telling us about romanticy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bridget Raimundo is an associate producer at CBC Books. You can find her on TikTok at Bridge Likes Books. And the titles she talked about today are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter.
Greetings. Rich Ninzinikaz. Rich is my name. I am from Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is located on Treaty 1 territory. I play in a band called Indian City. And our music is folk, pop, a touch of country. And we do our best to also incorporate Indigenous sounds as well as Indigenous themes with our music. And currently, I am reading a wonderful collection of poems entitled North End Love Songs by the incredibly talented Katarina Vermette. So this book takes place in the North End of Winnipeg, Manitoba, where I grew up. And Katarina is writing a collection of poems that deal with life in the North End, but also specifically deal with the loss of her brother, Wayne. I grew up in the North End. And so when she talks about the places that she talks about visiting, the houses that she talks about being in, the paths she talks about walking, I feel like I've walked these paths. You know, when she describes sitting in her front porch for a cigarette, I know exactly where she's sitting. My eyes, her words tell me exactly where she's at. And even the era, her brother Wayne was no doubt probably exactly my age, if not very close to my age. And judging by the life, the path that he led and the music he listened to and the things that he did while he was alive, I could have easily found myself in the company of Wayne and easily could have found myself being a great friend of his. So yeah, I just identified with everything she talked about. I would highly recommend this book to anybody who loves poetry, for one. But yeah, even if you don't love poetry, because I wasn't in that category. I wasn't someone who loved poetry before I read this book. And it has changed my view on poetry. It has opened up this incredible appreciation for the written word for me.
Dog-eared.
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 The books that never get old.
Hi, I'm Mona Awad, the author of Rouge, and a book I love to reread is The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. It's a brilliant, dark fairy tale about the shadow side of our fixation with youth and beauty. It's about the cost of transformation and how beauty and our desire for it shapes our relationship to life and to death. It's also about art making and how our creations betray our deepest desires and fears. Oscar Wilde is one of my favorite authors. I love the sharp humor in his plays. I love his devastating fairy tales. But The Picture of Dorian Gray is my absolute favorite work that he's written, and it might be my favorite novel, period. It's the kind of novel that's so atmospherically immersive and vivid and gorgeous, you just want to live there. You can smell the roses of it and the pink flowering thorn. It's completely enchanting.
Hi, my name is Kevin Major. I'm the author of 544 Toe, and a book that I like to reread is White Noise by Don DeLillo. And I remember reading that several years ago now, decades ago probably. And it was one of the very few books that I was actually led to laugh out loud. That's rarely happened. And I was so enamored with that book. And it's absurd in a sense, but it's also very much a reflection of our life and times, even as today. And I think, we're going through a really traumatic period in history at the moment. And, I won't mention why, but I think we all know democracy seems to be under peril at the moment. And a book like White Noise, I think put some of these things in context. So that's a book I like to reread.
We'll be back after these messages.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act.
I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Kate Hilton.
And I'm Elizabeth Renzetti.
And we're the authors of the new mystery novel, Bury the Lead.
And you're listening to The Next Chapter on CBC Radio 1.
Somewhere between the multiverse and everything, everywhere, all at once is the world we enter in The Other Valley. It's Scott Alexander Howard's debut novel, and he's imagined a town that exists in the present, past, and future all at the same time. Odile, the 16-year-old protagonist, is vying for a spot on the Conseil, or the Council. It's the elite group of people who accept or reject people's petitions to cross the 20-year divide between valleys. But when Odile sees something she wasn't supposed to see one day in the schoolyard, she's expected to keep her mouth shut and make some tough decisions. Scott Alexander Howard joins me now from Vancouver. Hi, Scott. Welcome to The Next Chapter.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, Scott, you were formerly an academic. Some people I know in that world call themselves recovering academics. But I think, you know, you studied philosophy and the nature of time. It feels like that work comes out in your writing. So I wanted to ask you, how does your past academic life intersect with your writing life?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've been thinking about it a lot lately because it's funny. I think that this novel is kind of my exit from philosophy. And now in having conversations about the novel, I'm talking about philosophy more than I had for several years. So I think that maybe I carried more of my philosophical kind of background into this than I was aware of. You know, I think it might've just kind of shaped the way that I think and the way that I approach, you know, questions. So even though I'm like, okay, I'm done with philosophy, I'm leaving, I'm recovering, as you say, I think maybe it's still sticking around.
So the world of this story is unique. The same valley, but 20 years ahead in the east, 20 years behind in the west, and both heavily guarded. What inspired you to create this reality?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of rendering time travel as just as simple as geographical travel. So sort of the original conceit of the book was like, what if there was no time machine? What if there was no wormhole or portal or anything like that? What if it was as simple as walking to the past or future? That image, I'm not really sure where it came from, but I know when it came. I was living in Toronto and a friend of mine was about to pass away. She was in hospice. And this is about 10 years ago. You know, I had this idea long before I did anything with it. And so we were kind of in that awful period of just sort of waiting. And the idea of getting to visit her again was sort of floated, but then it turned out that things were moving too quickly and most of her friends didn't get to see her again after she went into hospice. And it was during those days when I suddenly had this image come to me of just the same town across the landscape repeating over and over and over again. And I think the personal context of where that idea came from sort of explains why I always knew that the primary use of time travel in this world was going to be for grieving or for mourning, as opposed to any kind of more action-oriented tropes. I always thought it was going to be about emotions. And I think that's probably, you know, due to where I was at when that idea came.
Sorry for the loss of your friend, but I can also imagine that this is, you know, having experienced similar things with friends, you're like, what do we do now? What do we do with this? But it's interesting that this book kind of is almost an ode to your friend or a connection to her life.
Yeah, she was a writer, and I wish that I could show it to her. Mm. Yeah.
So in the other valley, we meet Odile, the protagonist. She's at a crucial moment in her life. She's 16. She's about to choose her career path. She's an awkward and shy teen, and like teenagers do at that time of life, she falls in with a new group of friends. Why did you choose that time of life for your heroine?
I think that there was a period, I think right around the time that I was Odile's age, when I was around 16, I had a friend group kind of coalesce, and it coalesced quite quickly, and we knew there was an expiration date on it because one key member was about to move back to Europe at the end of the month. So we had this one May when we were all 16, and that impending ending kind of made the whole thing much more precious and sort of painfully romantic. You know, we knew we had this very little time as a group, and so it's very poignant, and I just liked that setting. I liked the idea of setting a story in that same atmosphere of like highly concentrated teenage emotion. You know, there's times of our lives that seem kind of pre-compressed in terms of their events and their emotions to sort of almost be like the structure and meaningfulness of fiction already. So I kind of liked exploring that.
Yeah, my 16-year-old compressed time was playing basketball until it got dark and then drinking in a park. This is much more sophisticated, but enjoyable nonetheless. One of her new friendships is with one of her classmates, Edme, who's a talented violinist, soft-spoken but funny. But the problem is that she has seen his future. And what has she learned about him, and how did she get that information?
Yeah, so the idea of the book is that travel, as you said, between these valleys is strictly regulated. You know, there's these highly guarded borders between the neighboring towns, which represent the sort of future, present, and past. And the only way that you are allowed to travel between these places is by petitioning on the basis of some kind of loss, some kind of personal loss, and usually grief. And so if you see visitors from the future in your town, you know that they are here on what is sort of in the slang of the book called a mourning tour. You know that they're here to look at somebody who is alive in your town, but in their town 20 years in the future must have passed away. And so what Odile sees is Edmé's parents. She's not supposed to recognize them because these visitors, they come in masks, they come under armed guard. But due to a little accident, she recognizes that it is Edmé's parents. And she is smart enough to put together that that means that, that Edmé doesn't have long to live. And she's the only person who has this knowledge. And it creates a pretty awful dilemma for her that sort of we follow the ramifications into her adulthood.
Well, it was an interesting dilemma to read about because I was wondering, you know, personally, would I withdraw from that person completely? I'd have to be, you know, potentially away from them so I don't say the wrong thing. But in Odile's case, despite knowing that Edmé is going to die, she can't resist getting to know him. What draws them to each other?
The thing about Odile is that she's extremely lonely. You know, the way she starts out the book, she's very, very shy and she's very, very lonely. And I think that there's something maybe about having this knowledge, this secret sort of foreknowledge about Edmé that, I mean, she speculates on it herself in the book. She asks whether, you know, why is it that I suddenly kind of became friends with him after never having done so before? Was it some kind of like liberatory abandon? You know, was there this sense of like, I don't know, she's seen something so extreme about him that she can just kind of like let go of her hangups and approach him. So there's sort of the personal side of it, and there's also that she is somewhat tasked by the Conseil, which is sort of the governing body of these towns, to sort of spy on him and his family for reasons that I won't get into. But she's sort of also kind of given this job as a sort of collaborator or informant to make sure that Edmé doesn't suspect what's coming, basically.
You mentioned that your academic research focused on memory and emotion, and those are themes that are central to the novel. Did your understanding of those two concepts change or evolve as you wrote this story?
I don't think that they changed while I was writing the story, no. I think that they just kind of deepened. I think that, you know, I was thinking about grief a lot while I was writing this. I was thinking about the kinds of advice that we get when we're grieving, and one thing you'll encounter, so basically when you're in the throes of grief, I think that oftentimes you'll sort of be told, like, don't make big decisions. You know, you're tempted to suddenly kind of upend your life. You know, you're tempted to maybe move away from the town you're living or end a relationship or leave a career. And then people kind of come back to you and say, well, no, that you're in the middle of a storm right now. You should wait. You know, you're not thinking straight. And, you know, everybody's different. So I'm not going to make any prescriptive claims about that, but I am a little bit skeptical of that cautionary advice. I found that when I, you know, lost some friends in my early 30s, it kind of jolted me out of a certain amount of inertia. You know, I was in academia and I was kind of just plodding along because I'd already sunk so much time into it. So I thought, well, I better just keep going, even though I wasn't really happy, you know, and I knew in my heart that I wasn't happy. And so I think that when I was writing the book, I kind of put some of that into Odile's experience. I sort of let her, you know, upend her life when she's in the throes of grief, which for her is maybe a mistake. For me, I don't think it was. But I guess I was exploring the kind of contours of that decision in the book.
You know, Scott, I have to mention this as well. Reading about this, the world of the other valley, it was reminiscent of the Okanagan region in BC. You have a little sprinkling of Italian and Spanish, but I connected with all the French, from Odile's name to the Conseil to her, you know, friends and family. It's very French, and having a love for the French language, having grown up in Quebec most of my life, I was drawn to all of that. Why would you decide on that mix of names and identifiers?
Well, first of all, yeah, you nailed it with the Okanagan. I'm from the southern interior. And I don't know. I think that there's kind of like, there's a few whimsical reasons why the French first started to sort of pop up in the drafts. And then there's sort of the more kind of functional reasons why it stuck around. You know, like when you're just starting to write something, you know, you kind of throw things in and see if they stick. Mm. And so a couple of the reasons for that, I think one, I was as part of my day job, I was editing a book about the cartography of Paris, sort of 19th century stuff. And there was a lot of French place names. There was names like, I got Edme's name from that book, for example. So I just kind of liked the names. I was reading some novels by Patrick Modiano at the time too. So there's a lot of French place names floating around in my brain. And I think that they felt appropriate because the Southern Okanagan is a weird landscape in Canada. When I was traveling in kind of the Southern or in the Mediterranean, you know, there's that same kind of like barren mountains with like above like a lush sort of ecosystem going on. And so I thought, you know, these names kind of fit this landscape too. But I think that the reason why it stuck around was that, I don't know, it sort of suited the sort of world building I was doing in the book, you know, because I didn't want to go so far as to have sci-fi fantasy names that are based on fictional languages. You know, I wanted the world to feel a little bit more familiar than that. But I also didn't want to just have characters named Scott, for example. I wanted to kind of hover between the familiar and the unfamiliar. And so for most of the readers of this book, like Anglo readers anyway, I felt like the foreign language, the foreign names kind of suited that. They kind of achieved that same, you know, sort of familiar, sort of unfamiliar balance.
Yeah, for the first 15 pages, I was like, clearly this is translated from the French, and it's Scott Alexandre Howard. Then I had to go look at the Simon & Schuster website. I was like, no, these are just choices. Neither of us want to give away too much, but I think I can say that the book is divided into two sections with a time jump in between. Odile is still the narrator, but the pacing is definitely different. How did you juggle the writing of those two sections?
The first half of the book is pretty compressed into a pretty short period of time. And then the second half sort of traces more or less 1 year. And it's when I figured that out, it kind of unlocked it for me. For a long time, I was kind of trying to sort of, as I was writing it, trying to sort of give it the same kind of compressed time period, and it wasn't working. I needed to sort of like relax and allow us to see Odile's life as an adult on a slightly larger canvas than we see her teenagehood in the first half.
Was it a difficult thing to leave some elements of the first part behind?
Yes. And that's why I think it's a great relief when you sort of start to see some of the characters in the first half kind of gradually come back into the second. But there's a very kind of specific reason why I wanted that jump. I wanted the reader to miss childhood in the way that Odile misses her childhood, you know? And so I wanted the sort of seam in the middle of the book to kind of put the reader in the same place that she is emotionally.
All right. So, you know, we're talking right now before the book comes out. By the time this airs, the book will have come out. So I wanted to ask you, your little baby has come out into the world. How does it all feel?
yeah, I think there is that kind of publication day, like saying that, you know, your book baby is being born. And I do think that like developmental analogies are actually pretty appropriate because you've sort of, there's so much of you in a book, but then it's also this distinct creature, you know, like when you're writing at some point, the story starts to tell you what it wants to be and you can't impose your will on it anymore. You just have to sort of facilitate its growth into the thing it's going to become regardless. And I think though that like the child sort of metaphor that makes the most sense here is kind of sending your kid off to school, you know, like right now standing at the, you know, the bus stop and just waving goodbye and saying, well, I can't, you know, I've prepared you for the world as best I can. And how it goes from here is largely out of my control. So it's, I feel this kind of, I don't know, this acute love for it and also this anxiety for it because I know that I can't really protect it anymore.
Right. For whatever it's worth, Scott, I have great faith that this child will not be bullied in school and will achieve great things. It was an incredibly enjoyable read. Congratulations on it.
Thank you so much.
Scott Alexandre Howard is the author of The Other Valley. He spoke with me from Vancouver. I spoke with Christine Estima last fall when she came in to talk about her debut collection of stories, The Syrian Ladies Benevolent Society. It traces the story of an Arab family fleeing the Middle East and settling in Montreal. The upheaval of the 20th century was writ large in her characters' lives, and that's a period in history that fascinates Christine. She plans to set her next book in the period between the two world wars, and as a reader, she seeks out novels set in the early part of the 20th century. Christine is here now to share three of her favorite reads that take place in that era. Hi, Christine. Welcome back to The Next Chapter.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So what is it about the 20th century that you find so compelling?
The 20th century specifically, I think in the early half of it, is just loaded with so much upheaval and so much change. The 20th century is really interesting because so much advancement in society and technology happened within that one century, way more than in the 19 centuries that came before it. And so what you get is this really interesting pocket of time where we're starting to, you know, lurch towards modernity, but there's still little bits of the old world society still peppering it, you know? So you get people who are interested in machinery and automation, but they still have like top hats and watch fobs, you know? And in terms of how society operated, in terms of the manners and norms and societal expectations, we have kind of lost some of that. And I find that period really interesting, specifically because we had two world wars.
Mm-hmm.
Almost back to back. And so those wars advanced, I think, society for better or for worse in a way that we hadn't seen in the 19 centuries before it.
All right. And that is the theme for the reading that you've been doing and the three books, the three novels that you've brought in today. So tell me about this first novel.
So the first book is The Tobacconist by Robert C. Toller. This is an incredible tome. It's not even that big, but it really packs a wallop. And this takes place in Vienna in the interwar period. So like the last golden days of like, you know, the 1930s. And the Anschluss, which is the annexation of Austria, is about to happen when the book starts. And we follow this young boy, his name is Franz, and he comes from like, you know, a small countryside town. And he needs to help his family earn money. So his mother sends him to go work at a tobacconist shop in Vienna. And that's another thing, like, do we even have tobacconist shops anymore? Like now you just go to like the corner store, a Depenner, and like you buy like cigarettes or something. But a shop that just specializes in selling tobacco is just so quaint, and you know, I just love it. Yeah. You know,
you're preaching to the choir on that. I love that.
Exactly, kind of thing, yeah. Right? And then in the book, what happens is one of the clients that keeps showing up at the tobacconist is the professor Sigmund Freud. And Franz falls in love with this young Czech girl that he meets in Vienna, and he keeps showing up at Freud's, you know, office and asking him questions about love and life and how to deal with pain and loss and mourning and healing and hope. Meanwhile, Freud, who is Jewish, is being persecuted as the Anschluss happens and the Nazis take control of Austria and they annex it. And he is slowly dying of like jaw cancer, and he knows he has to flee to England. And so amongst this kind of small story of this young boy, this country bumpkin in the big city, you also have a larger scene of like a city that is about to be thrust into the epicenter of history. Mm-hmm. And Vienna is just a really interesting city if you're interested in kind of like, you know, the microcosm of the 20th century kind of bursting forward in the early part, because Vienna was, you know, the heart of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which collapsed after the Great War in 1918. They were a destroyed city for like those 20 years between the two wars. There were coal shortages and there was bread lines. People were starving. Women were selling their bodies. Men were coming home with like hastily patched up faces and phantom limbs. And, you know, you really kind of understand why it became like this important catalyst for like what was about to happen in Europe in the 40s.
It's very interesting. As you say, it's not a tome. It's a shorter book than you would think, given how rich all this subject matter is.
Absolutely.
But as you say, it looks like it packs a wallop. All right. What is next on your list today?
Next would be A History of Burning by Janika Oza. She's a Canadian author, and this is her debut novel. And this is an incredible story that I think is underreported a lot in history. I don't think a lot of people know about this story. It's about young Indians. It's a family who, and they were kind of tricked by, you know, British colonialism into being sent over to Uganda and into Eastern Africa to build the railway lines there. You can track them through time, like the story kind of starts in like 1890 and follows them through the history in Eastern Africa and Uganda, where they are being ostracized and they are being used by first like the British colonialists, and then later on when Idi Amin in like the 1970s comes to power, and the way that they are again ostracized by the locals in Uganda, and the way that they have to like consistently throughout their family history find a way to survive in a society that wasn't designed with them in mind.
I read this book in the fall, and I found it incredibly compelling, partly also because of my own family's connection to colonialism and also all the people I know who had to leave Africa in the 70s. Tell me how Janika Oza shows the fallout from all that history in the lives of her characters.
Yeah, it's kind of like a family trait that she writes about. Each family member almost has a kind of stoicism to them, like they take on a huge degree of pain and suffering that within their own lives. Like the very first character we meet, his name is Purbhai, and the only reason he wants to take on is tricked into traveling to, you know, Eastern Africa is because he's told that there'll be work there. Instead, he's like forced into indentured servitude, essentially slavery, right, in order to earn back his passage. But he takes it on with like this kind of quiet, like, I need to do this for my mother, for my family. And all around him, he sees suffering, and all around him, he sees pain, and he internalizes that. In the very first couple of chapters, we see Purbhai being forced by the British colonialists to burn a village in order to lay the railway tracks. And that is an act that sticks with him for the rest of his life. Even though, you know, the village, there was no one in the village at the time, he still burned it. And the title, I think, is quite apt there, because what we see is throughout the tracking of this family through time, it's not just about, you know, physical acts of burning like the burning of a village. It's also about the fire that burns within us. Mm-hmm. And that fire can be transmitted through our families down the line.
All right. What is the third book on your list?
The third book is A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. And this is it's an incredible kind of plotless but engaging book, in that we meet this man, his name is Count Rostov, and it's around 1917. And if you know anything about Russian history around them, the Bolsheviks were uprising and they took over the country. And men who were of the previous aristocracy were considered a threat to this new way of doing things. And so Count Rostov, because he was an aristocratic man, he was of letters, he was an elite, as we would say today, he is forced to live out the remaining days of his life inside the Hotel Metropole in Moscow. He's not allowed to leave it. And so he lives in this hotel starting in 1917 all the way through to the end of his days. And so what you get is a book that isn't very heavy on plot, because the book is basically about like the people that he encounters, the other guests, the underworking machinations of how a hotel operates. And there's like these American actresses that are coming to stay, and there's a lively kind of bar crowd. And so it's more, I think, a look at the manners and society of the time, which, just kind of like Robert Seetaler, is like a really interesting way of kind of revealing the entire life of a man. It's just super interesting to be stuck inside this hotel while the world around him, and Russia, you know, which was the Soviet Union, which was embroiled again in wars and uprisings and the rise and fall of communism. And he's just watching it all happen from the window in Moscow.
As you say that he's stuck in the hotel, it occurs to me, you know, this is a man stuck between more than that. It's old world and new world.
Absolutely.
And this theme of being caught between the old and the new. This runs through all these books
Absolutely.
That you've picked today. Why does that theme hold so much appeal for you?
I just love this idea that we never know that we are in the middle of history when we're sitting here. And I think that that is what permeates a lot of books that are set in the early part of the 20th century, is that nostalgic sensation that we are looking at a moment in time where everything was changing, but the people in those moments didn't realize it. And so you can kind of, as the reader, can see the things that the characters can't see.
Christine, thank you for these three recommendations and for sharing your joy about this time period.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christine Estima is the author of The Syrian Ladies Benevolent Society, and the books that she recommended today are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. And that is it for our show today. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews. My thanks this week to Laura Antonelli, Olivia Pasquarelli, Talia Cleot, and to the CBC Books digital team. Coming up next week, a big city journalist joins the staff of a small town newspaper in cottage country. And from there, a murder mystery unfolds in Bury the Lead. It's a collaboration between Kate Hilton and Elizabeth Renzetti, and they'll join me next week to talk about co-authoring A Whodunit. And our columnist Talia Cleot will bring us three campus novels that capture the hothouse atmosphere of uni days. I'm Ali Hassan. Thanks for listening to The Next Chapter.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.